And joining us on the book club today is Kate Winkler Dawson. Kate is a seasoned documentary producer whose work has appeared on the New York Times, as well as WCBS News, ABC News Radio, PBS NewsHour, and Nightline. She is the author of Death in the Air, The True Story of Serial Killer, The Great London Smog, and The Strangling of a City. And she teaches journalism at the University of Texas at Austin. And the book that we're going to discuss today is American Sherlock, Murder, Forensics, and the Birth of American CSI. Kate, again, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Louie.
Let's start a little bit about with your background, as we discussed before the interview started. Tell us about your growing up, your childhood.
Well, I grew up in Austin, Texas, and, you know, born and raised, very proud Texan. And my father was a professor at the law school here at the University of Texas. So I grew up going to his classes. He taught criminal law and criminal defense. And so, you know, I've been listening to stories about forensics for my whole life. And he actually started the Actual Innocence Clinic at UT Law School. And so, you know, the last few years of his life, he and I talked a lot about wrongful convictions and the different reasons why that happens. So, you know, in my world, talking about crime and why people commit crime and why they're prosecuted and the problems with it, this was all sort of dinner talk for me. My mother was a clinical psychologist, and she just loved true crime books. So that my parents still live in the same house where I grew up. And I was looking at the bookshelf the other day, and it's just filled with books from my childhood, from what my mom read and what I flipped through. And it's like every Stephen King book you can think of, and In Cold Blood and other true crime books. So, you know, this is the world between this and being a television news producer. This is the world that I grew up in. So it was very, it was almost like common sense that I would end up writing these types of books, which is sort of a melding of science with murder.
Kate, tell us a little bit about, and you just mentioned In Cold Blood, which I remember as a kid, we weren't allowed to watch it when it came out on television. But much later, I did read the book and heard the audiobook. And it seems like it, you know, it's making a comeback. They have a series on In Cold Blood. But what? Why do you think we are so interested in death?
Oh, gosh, there's so many reasons. So one thing that's interesting, two things that are interesting. One is that absolutely the dominant audience for true crime stories is women, which seems surprising. You know, I'm a woman who writes about mostly about men killing women. And so you would think that this would be something that would be difficult for me to do and difficult for women to listen to, but it just isn't. And I think there are a few reasons. One, usually these stories, you know, you can feel a little bit removed. Many times these are stories that aren't happening in your backyard. And I actually shy away from reading about stories that have happened in Austin because I live here. And it seems too close, you know? So I think that true crime stories in general, speaking for, you know, the perspective of a woman, I think there are a lot of things. One, there's a little bit of that better them than me kind of thing. There's a little armchair quarterbacking, like, well, I would have never done this, or I'm glad I'm not married to this person, you know, or this is a situation I would have changed, and here's how. Which, of course, is easy to say after the fact. I think there are a lot of lessons learned, following your instincts, if you see red flags with someone. But I also think it can, in some ways, lull you into a sense of security because, you know, we certainly hear that when police officers investigate a murder, you're looking at the inner circle first, you know, and then you spread out. And who wants to think that there's a potential killer in their own inner circle? So I think there are a lot of different reasons. My mom is a big, as I said, true crime fan, and I asked her why she watches all these shows, which I watch too. And my mom's 76, and she said, well, I think it prepares me if something's going to happen. And I'm not sure if she thinks it's going to be like a serial killer popping out of a closet, what she's preparing for, but it's her reason. I think there's a lot of different reasons. I also thought another thing was really interesting. I just read an article about a poll that was taken among true crime fans that said somewhere in the realm of 50 to 60% of true crime fans actually root for the criminal in some cases, right? So you hear this about around diehard true crime fans that they have a favorite killer, like a Ted Bundy, or, oh, yes, and the Sam is my favorite killer, which seems so grotesque and morbid. But I think it's a voyeurism. I think it's, in some ways, the reason why we watch sci-fi. You know, it's a different world that we're being dropped into. God willing, it's a world we're never going to have to enter. And you can look at it from a little bit of distance, with a little bit of detachment. And it is a struggle. It is good versus evil. There is a natural story, a beginning and a middle and an end. And somebody is inevitably changed by whatever the result is. If the person's not caught, if they are caught, if they go on trial, if they get away with it, if they're convicted, somebody is changed by the end of this process, whether it's the victim's families, or the survivors, or the killer. And that's just good storytelling.
We're visiting with Professor Kate Winkler-Dawson. She is the author of the most recent book, American Sherlock, Murder, Forensics, and the Birth of American CI. At what point, Kate, did you decide to sit down and say, I'm going to write this book? Or did it start out perhaps as even a feature or a story in a newspaper or a magazine, and then you said to yourself, this needs a lot more?
No, I was absolutely on the look for a second book. So when I found the story of the Siskiyou train robbery and I, you know, read more about Oscar, I went through this checklist of things that I always go through anytime I'm thinking about any kind of project. And one of the things on there, so I'll go through the checklist because I think it's very pertinent to anyone who writes about a good story. One is I wanted it to be a story that really no one had ever heard of. Well, check. He doesn't even have a Wikipedia page, let alone another book written about him. Number two, I really want it to be a time period that I'm super interested in. And to me, I can't get a better time period in some ways than this decade. So the book starts in 1920 and ends in 1933. And you go from prohibition and in huge amounts of crime to the roaring 20s with lots of money to in the jazz age to the Great Depression. And so as you go through the book, you see the way Oscar's life changes, sometimes directly because of what's happening in the United States and just because of, you know, how he changes as a man, as an investigator. And then the another thing I look at is the area. I love San Francisco. I lived in San Francisco. I thought that that was a world that I could recreate, 1920s in San Francisco on the West Coast. And then the most important thing to me that tops all of this is this somebody's voice I can capture? Because I don't think I will ever do a book. Well, I know I will never do a book that is solely based or predominantly based on newspaper accounts, because I need more substance. And Oscar's son donated his entire lab after his father died to UC Berkeley, where Oscar taught classes in criminology for about 40 years. And this archive is unbelievable. It's more than 100 boxes. It had been closed for about 60 years because it was such a large collection. I had to petition UC Berkeley and give an explanation for why they needed to take the time to open up the archive and, you know, catalog it and allow me to research it. And in that archive was everything I needed. It was his case files, his notes, personal diaries, personal letters to his family, from his wife, to his wife, from his sons, to his best friends, who all happened to be very famous. So they had their own archives. So I have his son, who was a really big deal, his eldest son, Theodore, was a really big deal in the museum world. And so I called the archive at Canada, where the son, you know, used to teach, and said, I need you guys to take pictures of every letter that Oscar sent his son. And then Oscar kept all of his son's letters. So now you can match them up based on date, and I have conversations. And you just don't get that in narrative nonfiction books. That's like a fiction book thing. That's not nonfiction. Very rarely do you get both sides of a conversation. And so that's why the book really reads like fiction, because there was so much to draw from based on pictures that he took, from his case files, based on the evidence that he held on. He had bomb parts. He had loaded guns in his, you know, files. He had locks of hair. He had, you know, writing samples that he had kept for years. So there was so much to draw from to really give you not just a picture of who this man was as an investigator in the field and in a lab coat in his lab, but as a man, as a husband, and as a father. And it's a very, very complicated picture.
And you do a very good job of comparing also and showing us the different sides of the relationship between Oscar and his father and then Oscar and his son.
Yeah, and that was really important to me because, you know, a biography should encompass the person's life. They're so hard to do because you have to have that source material. And it was the white knight, the person who rides in on the horse, who's perfect, Prince Charming, I don't believe in. I don't think that's an interesting character. I don't think that's an interesting person. We are human. We make mistakes. As an investigator, he made some really big mistakes that I don't shy away from in the book. He ruined some lives that shouldn't have been ruined. But he also, you know, you walk away with a really good sense of why he had such bravado, why he had such an enormous ego when he was in public, but in private, when he's writing his son, when he's writing his best friend, the incredible amount of vulnerability that he shows just was never seen by the media or the public or even some of his other friends. He's only vulnerable in certain times. And so finding those letters, particularly when I put together his, I don't want to ruin how his father died because it's really pivotal. It really informs the rest of his life that his father dies when Oscar is in his teenage years and Oscar finds him. But, you know, the letters to his son about how Oscar grew up and how he wants to avoid that kind of childhood by giving his sons better and the financial pressure that he feels because of that. And he's constantly running from debt collectors. He's much more scared of debt collectors than he is of the criminals who he's testifying against. I mean, he's really scared of the bank shutting him down because he was so close to that happening. So that personal aspect, you know, of his life is so important because he has such control over his professional life and it seeps into his personal life. And it's very problematic. Somebody who has that much of a grasp on everything, eventually you're going to lose control. And then what happens?
We're visiting with Professor Kate Winkler Dawson. She is the author of the latest book, American Sherlock, Murder Forensics and the Birth of American CSI. Kate, at the beginning of the book, I think it's in your introduction, yeah, I think it is, where you discuss kind of setting the scene for us. And you mentioned this a little while ago also, and I think people may be surprised as why crime had skyrocketed in the 20s.
Well, it was Prohibition, which is interesting because that was the exact opposite of what the goal of Prohibition was. You know, I mean, in about 1919, 1920, when Prohibition started, the idea behind it was to take America back to the morals, supposedly good morals of the Victorian era, you know, where there's chastity and there's, you know, they're taking back control and giving the government control of alcohol. And you know, the hope was that America would go dry, stop drinking, find religion, and there would be less crime, less domestic abuse, more employment, that it would just sort of cleanse the nation of all of the ills that we had. And it was the opposite effect, the exact opposite effect, because nobody anticipated, I suppose, that Americans were not willing to stop drinking alcohol. And so up pops people who are willing to provide illegal alcohol, and it created the crime syndicates, the mobs. That was the creation of mafias, is, you know, people taking advantage of black market, and that's what happened. And crime went up by 80% during Prohibition. Drunk driving went up by an enormous amount, as did domestic violence. So, you know, it was the opposite effect. And it took a long time for Prohibition to be repealed, more than 10 years. But once it finally happened, we were left in the wake of all of the damage that had been done. So this was a busy time for Oscar Heinrich. I mean, he was hired all the time because crime was skyrocketing. So in some ways, Prohibition was the best thing that ever happened to him because you know, cops needed him, district attorneys needed him, defense attorneys needed him.
Tell us about when you first introduced us to the first case, and that involves the Lamson family. And this is a part where you say that most of the Stanford professors lived, including former President Herbert Hoover. But this story is really bizarre of what happened to Mrs. Lamson.
Well, and it's, for me, probably the biggest, the case with the biggest mystery. I don't want to really ruin too much of it, but, you know, David Lamson was a young man who he was in his 20s, and he was a executive at Stanford University Press. He was a writer. He was very successful, very handsome, and his wife Aileen was, you know, beautiful and very smart, and had a master's degree, which was really unusual for anybody in the 1920s and 30s, let alone a woman, and successful. And a Memorial Day weekend in 1933, the two of them retire after going to a whole series of parties that left Aileen really exhausted and not feeling well, and the two retire to bed. David wakes up the next morning and takes care of Aileen by bringing her some breakfast. She's still not feeling well, draws her a bath, takes her to the bathroom, and she gets into the bath. And then he leaves and goes, starts a bonfire in the backyard and talks to neighbors. It's a beautiful weekend. He's cutting down blackberry bushes and depositing, it seems like, everything in the backyard into this bonfire. And he takes his shirt off. And so it's sort of a lot of socializing, some gossiping. And in the meantime, Aileen's taking a bath, and there's a doorbell ringing, and there's an unexpected visitor, and the woman who is a real estate agent, the Lamsons wanted to rent out their cottage and for the summer. And they have a little girl who is spending the night at her grandparents, and they're trying to get her out of Central California, Northern California, because she's having really bad sinus infections. And so they're renting out the cottage for the summer. So there's a real estate agent with a client who drops in unexpectedly and asks to come inside. And David says, well, my wife is in the bathtub, but I'll let you in. So he puts on his shirt and he walks inside, and his wife is dead in the bathroom. And within about 15 minutes, he is, you know, under arrest. When police come, and they suspect that he has beaten her to death. And Oscar Heinrich is hired by the prosecutor, and he comes in and has a very different opinion. And so the case really unravels around bloodstain pattern analysis. So how she, you know, did she fall? Was she beaten? How the blood is spattered across the room? Was there somebody standing behind there? What's the proof? Is there a motive? All of this is a big mystery. And so the book begins with that case and then ends with that case. And the idea for me was to really be able to show his journey. So you know what the end game, which is that David Lamson is depending on Oscar Heinrich's skills in 1933 to free him. But we know, starting from 1920, which is the third chapter, how this goes. We know what his skills are in 1920, and when he finally arrives in the Lamson case 13 years later, what's his reputation? Does he have a good reputation? What new skills has he acquired? Is he going to be able to get this guy off? And quite frankly, the bigger mystery is, should he have worked as hard as he did to get this guy acquitted? And we don't know what happens. And I'm not going to tell you what happens.
No. Well, I already know what happens, but I don't want anybody else to know. The butler did it. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about, you mentioned earlier about the train robbery, and a lot of people who know Western history, they associate the James Gang, Frank and Jesse, for robbing trains. But this particular train robbery actually never really happened.
It didn't. So if you read in history books, it's called America's Last Great Train Robbery, which is so funny because they never actually were able to rob the train. They were the most inept bank robber, or I'm sorry, they were the most inept train robbers, I think, in history, because this trio of brothers didn't know what they were doing. They just knew that their heroes, right, the Jesse Jameses and Butch Cassidy and all these folks, were getting away with millions. and that there was gold and money and mail and everything under the sun, you know, on these trains, and that they were fairly easy to rob. And that was true in the 1800s. It was not as true when they were trying this, which was in 1923. In this time period, the banks were wising up. They were putting U.S. Marines on trains armed with guns. They made safes so that you couldn't just kind of pop in on a moving train on horseback, grab some cash, and hop back off. I mean, these were in heavy-duty safes. And the U.S. Postal Service had armed guards. You know, they had official U.S. Postal federal workers riding on these trains also. So this was not an easy get, which is why you see kind of a dramatic drop in train robberies at the turn of the century. But that did not stop this particular group of brothers who decided they wanted to rob this train, and they used too much dynamite. And who knew? I did not really know how precise dynamite application is, but it's pretty precise, and they didn't know what they were doing. And so when they finally stopped the train, they blew apart a large part of the train, which blew apart, you know, the majority of the loot that they would have taken. So not only did they blow apart this train, scare passengers, and then ultimately shoot four different people, they didn't walk away with anything. And frankly, they ran away. They didn't get any money out of it. So it was all a waste of life, waste of their time. And, you know, ultimately, you'll have to find out if they're caught. But it's a really dramatic story where I think the only winner that comes out of it is Oscar Heinrich, because he's able to showcase every one of his skills in forensics on this particular case. He used everything: blood spatter, ballistics, botany, geology, criminal profiling. I mean, he really ticked down the list of just about everything, handwriting, everything that you could think of, he did.
We're visiting with Professor Kate Winkler Dawson. She is the author of the book, American Sherlock, Murder Forensics and the Birth of American CSI. What makes you wonder, Kate, if Oscar were still alive, what he would think of all the different stuff that has been coming up, the freeway California killer, how they caught him with DNA? And it would be interesting to, you know, see how he would react to all this.
Well, it's interesting. Somebody asked me what I thought his next technique would be were he still alive today. I think he would be interested, of course, in DNA. I mean, who isn't interested in DNA? I'm not sure if he would have latched onto genealogy as much as other people have. You know, he really liked science. It wasn't the digging in a database was not something I think that he would be interested in. That's part of profiling that I think could be interesting for him. But I think he really, really would have embraced neurology in the courtroom, which is dangerous. Neurology in the courtroom is dangerous. You know, being able to introduce a CAT scan or a, you know, CT scan or anything, any kind of scan, and say that this person has a pre-existing tumor or brain damage, or, you know, is a psychopath with reduced gray matter in these particular areas, and these are mitigating circumstances, and they should be either released or sent somewhere else or have their sentence reduced. I think that Oscar would have really loved the science behind it, but, you know, certainly I think it is abused in some circumstances, and I would hope that he wouldn't have abused it, but I think he just saw good tools. I think he just, you know, the peer reviewing that should have been done, the heavy research, the scrutinization that should be done on any scientific technique has not been done on so many of the things that we lean on now that make them unreliable. And I'm not sure he would have been the person to head up that sort of rigorous testing of new forensics. I think he would have happily used the tools, though.
Earlier you mentioned, I think our listeners will be surprised to hear this, that most of the true crime stories and criminal fiction, the biggest fans are women. And as I go down through some of the former guests I've had on the book club, I'm looking at some of the women I've interviewed, and most of them do write about crime. There's one man in my list here, that's Jonathan Kellerman, but I'm thinking Tess Gerritsen, Karen Slaughter, Lisa Gardner. Those are all, you know, some of the top women in fiction, crime fiction. And as you mentioned, there's a big genre out there. with this, but then also the audience is mostly female, is it, or just male as well?
No, I think it's male and female, but definitely women dominate that audience for sure. And, I think that women are attracted to writing about true crime. They're attracted to listening to it and listening about it and reading it. And so, it's no surprise that women, this is a genre for a lot of really creative women to do podcasts and TV series and writing books. Because we like to write what we know and what we're interested in. So, it makes a whole lot of sense.
We're visiting with Professor Kate Winkler-Dawson. She is the author of the book American Sherlock, Murder, Forensics, and the Birth of American CSI. Tell us about your job there working with the students. I mean, it must be awesome for the students to have a professor like you who has written these type of books.
Well, I hope so. I'm not sure if I have gotten that feedback from them. I think that it's important as a teacher for me to bring in real-world experience as a journalist. I mean, that's why I teach journalism. And so I think they appreciate that I can say, listen, I know you guys are planning for this, film shoot, or I know you're planning to cover this story. I'm doing the same thing. I have a complicated schedule, and this is how I solve some of those problems. Or I know you're struggling with this storyline, in your film. Let me tell you what I've tried to do. I use an Excel spreadsheet, and I break apart my chapters, based on columns in an Excel spreadsheet. That's been helpful for some students. So it's really satisfying to me to bring my own experience into the classroom for my students.
I'm not sure if you were aware of this, but last week was the 30th anniversary of a massacre that happened at a bowling alley in Las Cruces, New Mexico. And to this day, those gentlemen are still out there somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, that's really, it's so unfortunate that, you just usually the criminal has the upper hand, You're searching for them, and they have, been planning this. And so it's tragic. I mean, it's really difficult. There's always hope. And DNA, especially, boy, every year testing becomes more and more accurate, and there are more and more tools. So criminals should be worried, I mean, even if this was done 30 years ago, there's still hope, and I hope that that's a big takeaway for anybody.
What is the last or the most recent documentary you've done, Kate?
I would say probably the thing that I've done, I did something on an artist named Amado Pena, who's actually from your area.
Yeah.
And from El Paso. Yeah, but he was a teacher up there. So I did something on him. I did something with Nightline about sort of the dot-com boom. So I have a wide interest in different films.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Louie. I really appreciate it.
No problem. We've been visiting with Professor Kate Winkler-Dawson. She is the author of the book American Sherlock, Murder, Forensics, and the Birth of American CSI. Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Jacqueline Torres. We had help from Sam Cassiano. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louie Sainz.